Good afternoon, everybody. Today I'm here to talk to you about HIA. Health Impact Assessment, it's a combination of different procedures, methods, and tools by where you prospectively judge a project or a policy or a program and how that policy or program is going to affect the health of a community and subpopulations within that community, which is very important when you're looking at HIA. You really want to look at any kind of health disparities that might be occurring within different subgroups. As I said before, it's a prospective methodology, and at the end of the day, when you're finished with your analysis, you go to those policymakers with recommendations on how to minimize any negative health outcomes and increase any positive health outcomes. So it's a little different than your traditional research design. It includes both quantitative and qualitative analysis. It also involves a lot of community input. And it's been around for probably 15 years. It's been used extensively all over the world, especially the leaders are probably the UK. And in some countries, it's mandatory. Currently, most of the HIAs done in this country have been voluntary. The most important thing about a health impact assessment is that it brings health to the table. It gets people who are making huge decisions about how to allocate transportation dollars. Looking at one of my colleagues looks at mining developments and oil developments in Alaska. And for people who aren't really thinking about the health, it's like maybe you should start to think about how these decisions you're making, your policymakers, your engineers, how are the decisions that you're making in your job affecting people's health? They can be used both on projects and policies. Projects are typically affect a smaller group. It can involve just lots of different things. We've looked at parks, transit developments, highway developments. Policies are typically a little bit more difficult to do because you're looking, sometimes it's hard to tell exactly how the policy is going to be implemented, but they can affect much larger groups. Policies can affect, you know, an entire county, an entire state, or the entire country. You know, looking at everything from farm subsidized bills and on. Level of complexity, we do both qualitative and quantitative, and most HIAs use a combination of both of these methods, depending on the level of evidence that is available. Certain health outcomes like social capital and gentrification are typically harder to quantify. That does not mean they're not important, so you look at them with more of a qualitative analysis. Other impacts, sometimes physical activity, and I'll show you some of the injury analysis we've done, you're actually able to put numbers on it. Voluntary, and this is what most of the HIAs in this country have been done. You find the people who are interested in having an HIA done on their project, and you work with them. It's simpler, it's less litigious. You know, the mandatory, they're more likely to get done, but as in EIAs, environmental impact assessments, every statement has to be legally defensive, so it's more complicated, and sometimes if it gets put in an EIA, as Brian mentioned, he's read some that are about 20,000 pages. So, you know, your little bit of health statement can sometimes get lost in the regulatory documents. Community involvement, it's a key part of most of the HIAs that have been done in this country. Sometimes due to bureaucratic restrictions at CDC, it's very difficult to involve community in projects. So what we started doing is partnering with other organizations like UCLA and Georgia Tech, and they're able to go out and get that community input and involvement. Sometimes as a scientist, you don't always realize all of the social impacts of projects, which is why it's great to get the community to tell you. It's like, how do you think this project is going to impact your health? Although sometimes what you find, we were looking at a huge redevelopment project in Atlanta, and the one health concern the community was most worried about was air pollution. We did the scientific analysis and found out that Atlanta already has such horrible air pollution that this project, even though it was massive, wasn't going to make a dent in all of our wonderful purple air pollution days. However, the downside to community involvement, it can substantially increase the time and the resources, and sometimes it's very difficult to get all of your stakeholders and identify them and then get them to come to the meetings and talk to you about this. As I mentioned before, the large urban redevelopment, the affluent, mostly Caucasian neighborhoods were at the table. They were very able to articulate. They would do the web-based surveys. They were at their NPU, their planning unit meetings, and were very vocal. However, it was very difficult to get the people who lived in the lower income minority populations in the southern section to come and voice their opinions. Now, if I'm sure everyone's heard here about environmental impact assessments, and these are mandated by the National Environmental Policy Act, and it's been around for, 35 years. And the purpose of NEPA is to protect the human environment and stimulate the health and welfare of man. However, when you typically go through the EISs, they look at air quality and water quality. They don't always follow it through to all of the other health impacts of large projects. For instance, they don't look at, okay, we're going to see a 2% increase in particulate matter. They don't go then and say, okay, we expect an additional, 10,000 cases of hospital-related asthma attacks. So sometimes it really stops short of considering all of the health outcomes and especially taking it to that next level. So under NEPA, these have to get done. There's about 500 done every year. And while these have to be done and they have to say, okay, so for instance, we're looking at three different scenarios, they don't always have to do the one that's the most healthy. They just have to document how it's going to impact the health. Now, HIAs could logically fit within EIAs, but they're long, complex documents, and it could really get lost. It's time-consuming, expensive, litigious. And one of the shortfalls of EIAs is they only look at projects. It doesn't look at policies. And as I mentioned before, sometimes the policies have a much larger impact on health as opposed to singular projects. They often happen too late to affect design, reactive public involvement. So, ideally, while they have been incorporated into EIAs in Alaska, Aaron, one of my colleagues up there, has been doing some great work. Right now, we're focused more on the voluntary health impact assessments. However, there is an opportunity, as Aaron has done, to incorporate HIAs into EIAs during various stages of the EIA process. As I said before, this has been done all over the world, everywhere from New Zealand, Australia, Canada. It's actually, for a long time, it was mandatory to have this done in Canada. There's an increase in the U.S., and I'm going to talk a little bit about where we're currently at and the status of the science. Actually, this is a typo. When we started, we actually were trying to publish a paper about the first 16 completed HIAs, and while it's been under review, we're actually up to 27. So the number that are being completed in the U.S. are growing exponentially. So we've also been focused on training. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has been a phenomenal funder of the HIA efforts here in the United States, and we've probably conducted 10 to 12 training courses and have trained several hundred people just in the last few years. And if you were here on Saturday, we've got the American Planning Association, the National Association of City and County Health Officials, San Francisco Health Department, UCLA. There's a lot of institutional interest in bringing HIA to the United States. This is a map showing you the locations of where most of the HIAs have been completed. As you can see, California leads the pack. They've completed 15, most of those done by Rajiv Bhatia and Brian Cole. Aaron has also done three up in Alaska, and we've had a scattering across the eastern coast, one in Colorado and one in Minnesota. And this is just a list of all the HIAs done on projects. Everything, a lot of them are focused on housing redevelopment, highway redevelopment, and this just kind of gives you a flavor of the different ones that have been done. Here's a list of policies, living wage ordinances, oil and gas leasing. So you can really see these have been done on a wide range of projects and policies across the country. The organizations that have conducted it, academic groups, CDC, local health departments, there are some private consultants that do this, and tribal councils. The funder, Robert Wood Johnson, is kind of leading the pack with this. Actually, internal health department staff at the San Francisco Health Department, they have made this a part of their jobs. So they just do HIAs, when they're reviewing plans for typically your more infectious disease concerns. Volunteer university fellowship. So as you can see here, there's lots of different groups who are able to conduct these HIAs. The steps I'm going to go briefly through this screening, basically determining do you want to do an HIA, is it needed, and at what level are you going to conduct it? Are you going to do a mini rapid HIA, or are you going to do the full comprehensive several hundred page quantitative HIAs? scoping, you're determining who's going to be involved, how they're going to be involved, and what health impacts you're going to look at. Risk assessment, you gather the data, you do your quantitative and qualitative assessments, you formulate your recommendations, and then you go to your decision makers and you present the findings on how to mitigate the negative and increase the positive health impacts. And finally, evaluation. And there's several different types of evaluation that are done with HIAs. First of all, it's process, looking at, you know, what went well, what didn't go well. Every HIA I've been involved in, you walk away with lessons learned. Then you have impact evaluation. How did your HIA impact the decision that was made? Sometimes there has been great results, and other times the decision makers, the health is just not on the table. It's the decision is made based on funding or, you know, other decisions. And finally, outcome evaluation, which is, there haven't been that many done because it's very expensive to do this. First of all, for instance, we're looking at a highway redevelopment project. They have to make the changes to the built environment. Then you've got to go back and assess the health outcomes at the end of the day. The best example of a true outcome evaluation is the London congestion charging that was that's available on the web. They actually did a great job of assessing the outcomes, but they also had millions of dollars of funding. So if anybody knows of any additional funding, we'd be happy to do the outcome evaluations. So typically you want to do an HIA in areas where they're not already thinking about health. So you want to get those decision makers and policy makers who don't already have health on the table. You want to do it when you know there's going to be significant health impacts. We chose to look at Beaufort Highway in Atlanta because it had one of the highest rates of pedestrian injuries and fatalities in Georgia, if not the country. You want to complete the HIA before the key decisions are made. You don't want to go to the policymakers after they've already voted on the decision and then present your results. So you want to make sure that these are done in a timely manner. And, of course, having sufficient data and resources. As I said, on scoping, you basically determine who's going to be involved, what you're going to be looking at. Risk assessment, there's qualitative and quantitative. Qualitative, you pretty much say we expect that the parks are going to increase physical activity, and you also assign it a probability, whether it's speculative, you're certain, or you're uncertain about that health outcome. Quantitative, you actually put a number on it. With this increase in, you know, 1,000 acres of park space, we expect 1,000 people who live within half a mile of the park to engage in 20 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity a day. So it's just a matter of looking at the direction and certainty versus actually assigning a number to it. And this is a great quote by Jenny Mendel, and it's not everything that can be quantified is important, and not everything that is important can be quantified. Sometimes you're looking at very important health outcomes like social capital, and there's just not good baseline data, and there's not good impact estimation data. So but you go through and you do the best that you can in a quantitative manner. Steps in the assessment process, you gather your baseline data, and there's lots of different places you can go. Previous HIAs, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, the NHANES, gray literature, published literature. You assess the evidence, and if you're able to, you construct your quantitative models. There's several different ways that these are reported out. You have the full monster reports like the Beltline, which is about 250 pages, which only other HIA people are probably going to read, or if you just have problems with insomnia, I would recommend it. You know, on the other hand, when you go to your policymakers, you've got a brief 1-2 pager with the key recommendations, the findings, and this is probably what most people are actually going to read at the end of the day. As I said before, there's three different types of evaluation. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about one of the case studies that we were involved in. And this was a highway redevelopment project in Atlanta. As I said before, it's one of the most dangerous highways, high rates of pedestrian injuries and fatalities. It's 8 lanes of traffic. And what has happened as over time, there's apartments that ring this highway. And now it's home to a largely minority, low-income, transit-dependent population. So they have to run across 8 lanes of traffic to access grocery stores and transit. And it's frightening. Every time you drive down this road, you see people running with baby strollers and walkers across the highway. It's really frightening. So this is just an example of some of the lovely, you know, ADA accessibility. There's a curb cut, but no sidewalks. This is the cattle trail that people walk on. As you can see, it's very well worn. So what we did is we looked at, you know, what would happen if we reduced the number of lanes, we built sidewalks, added crosswalks, you know, add a center median, you know, and really redevelop this area. What are the health outcomes that we wanted to examine? And this is just another shot of Buford Highway as it is now. This is based on some architects at Center for Quality Growth and Regional Development, based on what it might look like after the redevelopment. Same thing here. You can see Buford Highway as it is today. You know what it might look like with the redevelopment. And so just to let you know, some of the things we looked at qualitatively included traffic, pollution, social capital, gentrification, crime and safety. Quantitatively, we assessed physical activity and injury. And I'm running out of time, so just quickly, let's see, this is just some of the background information. As I said before, it's a transit-dependent population, largely minority, lots and lots of injuries, 12 fatalities, and this is just in 8 miles. You're looking at about 19 injuries a year, 4 deaths a year, 8 miles. So it's really sad. This is just a map of exactly where the injuries happen, coded red for fatalities all the way down to purple for injuries. And these are all just pedestrian injuries. So as you can see, this one intersection, they actually had 4 fatalities. So in order to estimate expected injuries reduction due to the redevelopment, this is the formula that we used. We went and gathered all of the evidence from different sources, from other traffic calming measures that were used around the country. And at the end of the day, we estimated there would be a 90% reduction in pedestrian injuries and about a 60% reduction in automobile injuries. There were no automobile fatalities. Federal Highway Department did a great job in designing it for automobiles, but not so great for pedestrians. So this is just something when you're doing quantitative, we listed the assumptions. And currently we're working with the task force, with mayors, police chiefs. We've got a great task force working with Federal Highway and DOT to try to get these changes implemented and possibly more extensive pedestrian amenities that were originally proposed in the redevelopment plan. So this will just give you a flavor of health impact assessment. There's always challenges to doing these. Next steps, as we go forward, the case studies will be going up from 27 and just trying to figure out how to best do these in the United States, who's the best partners, and learning as we go, moving from research to practice. And honestly, this is a new and evolving science. It's got a lot of promise, and at the end of the day, the take-home message with health impact assessment is to get the key decision makers and the politicians to think about the health impacts of their decisions, which they're typically not doing.